Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. The agenda is in the IRC channel. On the agenda today, we have last call docs for the RDF working group, WebIDL, the dependency on WebIDL, issue 238, issue 223, JSON-LD options, base versus base, and then issue 229, the test suite. Anything else that needs to be updated or added to the agenda?
Yeah, I think there actually is. Let me see if I can find the link to it real quick. There was a commit where we were talking about, I think Marcus put a proposal somewhere in a commit, not in an issue. Yeah, I just found it. We should probably briefly cover that.
Okay. Is that something that needs to make it into the last call spec?
Well, it will change the output of compaction, so it might be important. And it shouldn't take that long to discuss, I don't think.
Okay, meaning there's fairly straightforward agreement on it, or?
Well, it might just be a fairly straightforward vote, just a quick discussion on a corner case.
Okay. Then we will, let's stick it. Is the second agenda item. All right. Any other updates or changes to the agenda? Okay. Marcus, would you mind scribing today? I can scribe for you when you need to speak.
Yeah, I can do that.
Okay, first up is the last call documents for the RDF working group. Marcus, I noticed that you had committed some last call docs. We probably just need to do some alignment on what needs to be there for the RDF working group. I think the date on them is wrong. It needs to be for next Thursday. At least the ones that we proposed to the RDF working group need to be for next Thursday.
Sandro about that, and he said that's the date I should use. So that's
the
reason.
That's, unfortunately, that was wrong, meaning that we can't publish. If it's not going to be published tomorrow, which date did you use? Was it the one for tomorrow or last week?
It's Friday, this Friday.
Yeah, so W3C doesn't publish anything on Friday.
Or, hang on, not Thursday, actually. The 11th.
Yeah. Have the docs been passed through pub rules? Have we done all the checks on them?
I did the checks. Yeah, they passed it. They passed
okay.
It.
And the RDF working group's going to publish on this Thursday?
Well, I don't know. I asked Sandra and he said I should use that date. But, well, if it's not done, we can change that date. We have to.
Yeah. Did we send a heads up to the publication team that it's gonna that do we have documents ready to go out this Thursday?
Not yet. We have to vote on that tomorrow. And
no, you have to do that before the vote.
Okay.
Maybe Sandra's talked to the publication team, but it's really a good idea to give them a heads up so that they can put it on the schedule, because it does require a decent bit of work on their end.
Okay.
And they usually like at least 1 or 2 days prior notice before publication.
So what do we do?
I don't know.
Send them
unfortunately,
an email,
Sandro's
or?
Not here. Yeah. Actually, yeah. Let's go ahead and send them an email, the pub rules team, and say that we're planning on doing a publication this Thursday. Actually, do you want me to go ahead and do that? I'll start up an email for that.
Sure.
And then I'll CC you so that you know what this stuff looks like. And then I'll CC Sandro as well and David Wood and Hoos.
And Yvonne, I suppose.
Yeah, and then we're going to say that it'll will go out to pub rules. Marcus, so you did use the W3C pub rules checker, checks CSS syntax, you went through all the manual checks as well.
Yeah, I think.
Okay. Okay, good. For both documents?
For both documents, yeah. Fantastic. I had to fix the markup. Sorry.
No, fantastic. It's great.
Yeah, the markup was broken, but I fixed it manually.
Okay, yeah, you have to do that from time to time. Okay, and then the only other thing, let's see. Oh, shit, has the transition request been approved by Tom Roessler?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I assume it has. You mean the
extension request? No, the transition request happens after the vote. So unless one of us has been in contact with Tom Roessler, he doesn't know that this thing's in the pipe.
I'm sure he knows it's in the pipe.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's a work product. In fact, it's late.
Well, what I mean is we are getting ready to go to last call, and he needs to review at least the front matter of the document and all that stuff. We can try for Thursday. I think it would be very difficult to get it done by Thursday. I don't know why Sandra said to do the date as tomorrow unless he has already taken care of all this stuff. But as far as any of us know, he hasn't.
Well, I don't know, yeah.
Okay, so how about I send an update to Tom Roessler as well?
Sure.
I mean the other reason that we delay the docs like this is to make sure that if the vote doesn't go through, we have some wiggle room, or if people have some reservations, we give them a week to speak up, and then we publish. Otherwise, people end up voting -1 on publication as a last call. If it's going to happen like immediately, they want more time. None of this stuff was okay. So I'm confused because none of this stuff was really discussed on the call last week.
Yeah, I mean, some people were even wondering why we weren't voting last week already, but it doesn't change much either way, I think.
Okay. Well, I guess then what we're going to do is we're going to try for a publication tomorrow. I will ping Tom Roessler and tell him that we're going to be going. We're probably going to be doing a publication, and to keep an eye out for the transition request.
Just to be clear, tomorrow's Wednesday. Seems like you're confusing
Thursday.
The dates.
Yeah, I mean Thursday. We're going to be publishing. Have you sent out an email to the chairs to notify them that we're going to last call with this document? That usually goes out a week before.
Well, it's on the agenda tomorrow.
No, the chairs for the W3C. Whenever you do a transition like this, you need to specify, you need to tell the chairs, the other chairs in other groups, that
apart
you're
from
call.
Preparing the document, I didn't do anything. I just talked to Sandra, prepared the document, and that's it.
Right. So I'm wondering if Sandro has done this, or if he just assumed that somebody else was doing this. Typically, this is on the chairs of the RDF working group to do, but I don't think they've been doing this. So, at least for Jason LB docs.
Why don't we just proceed as if that's going to happen, and if it doesn't, then we'll push it out a week.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Let me go ahead and write an email to the chairs as well. Sandra shouldn't have said that the date's tomorrow. Okay, all right. I'll get all these emails sent out today. But the docs are ready, so great job on that, Marcus, and we'll try to get this publication out Thursday.
Yeah, the only thing we might want to still change in the document, and that's something we're going to discuss today, is the web idle stuff.
Yeah. If we decide on making a change, it needs to be made immediately.
Yeah. But that shouldn't be a problem.
Okay. All right. Let's see. All right. So anything else on this? I need to send out a couple of emails, but the docs are in place.
No, I think that's it. There was one mail from Goose 1 or 2 hours ago saying that there was no reference to JSON LD in the abstract in the intro and status of the document section. So to the syntax spec. But there is one in the intro, and I'm not sure if it's needed in the other two sections.
Hmm. Okay. I mean, I don't see the harm in adding a reference to it.
No, sure.
Yeah. And I think your read on the situation is right, Marcus, which is we don't usually link to make references in the abstract. I know some specs do it, but it seems to be more of a distraction when you do that. Okay, anything more on the last call docs? All right.
Maybe minor question that you might be able to answer. What's the file name typically? Is it overview, as I saw in some places, or is it index.html?
Don't worry about it. The webmaster in the W3C will name it the proper thing. Okay. It's typically overview, but, I mean, it's just because of weird historical stuff at W3C. It's always been called overview since, like, late 90s.
Okay.
But our web server wouldn't pick up on that. It's only W3C's web server that picks up on that.
Okay.
So yeah, just leave it as is. Issue 238, Web IDL dependency. Here's the link. So this has to do with the reference we make to Web IDL. I was really confused with this assertion by Sandro of using the IDL harness. If this is what Robin is saying to do, we could do it, but this is the first time I've ever seen this.
There are a whole couple of other specs doing that.
Are they?
Yeah, I found a repository where there are heaps of such tests. I'm not sure if they have ever been used, but they are there.
Okay. Dave Longley, you said that you tried to get this working and there were some issues.
Well, there were just a few issues with it. We can't pass all of the tests because some of them require things to happen with the JavaScript implementation that are not possible. As far as I know, you can't change your JavaScript class to be stringified to. You can't change what the output is for a certain. For the type of operator or something like that, and the Web IDL test harness checks for that. You can't change it, as far as I know. And then there are a couple of other things with. If you use ECMAScript 5, you could make some of the other tests maybe pass a little bit more, but not completely, for marking certain properties as non-writable and non-enumerable. I don't really know what that buys us. Essentially, what it comes down to is I don't think all the tests could possibly pass with the JavaScript implementation because you can't do it. And then the other issue had something to do with sort of breaking convention with the order of parameters for the API. Apparently, the WebIDL spec says if you declare
a parameter optional, then every parameter that follows that optional parameter must also be optional.
Mm-hmm.
And that breaks convention with the vast majority of JavaScript libraries that place callbacks at the end of functions. And it breaks convention with that because we have this optional parameter called options that's a middle parameter that comes before the callback.
Mm-hmm.
So the one of the solutions to that problem could be to just also make the callback optional but throw an error if you don't provide it.
So I don't think we need to really change the interface. The interface needs to match what most web developers do with JavaScript today. We don't need to modify the interface just so it matches this IDL testing library at W3C, because it's not, you know, it's a general purpose library. It doesn't know all the normal ways that people use JavaScript today, or at least it looks like it has a bug in that it assumes things that it shouldn't assume.
That's a bit different because it's not allowed in WebIDLE. It's not that the testing script doesn't allow it. It's that WebIDLE itself doesn't allow it. So it would be an invalid WebIDLE definition.
Yeah, it's the actual specification. Yeah, I have a link.
But there, I had a discussion with Robin Bershon about that, and there might be a way around it. And one would be method overloading, which currently wouldn't also work. But Robin filed a bug report for that. So the problem with method overloading is that, here's the bug report. I'm getting some really loud noise.
I'm getting feedback too, Marcus. I don't know whose mic it is, but...
And now it's better. Now it's back. So one option would be to use method overloading. So in one method, we wouldn't have that options parameter, and in the other one, we would have the options and the callback parameter. But currently, that wouldn't work either in WebIDLE, because a callback isn't distinguishable from a dictionary currently. And that's something that, according to Robin at least, is a bug, and he already filed a bug report on that after our discussion. And while we discussed that, he really advocated to use futures instead of callbacks. So, already...
we're right before last call.
I know.
I don't think we
That's
can...
what I said as well. But here's the comment. That would look like this then. But that would introduce another dependency, which is the DOM specification. So that's where futures are currently being specified.
Mm-hmm.
And the last option would, of course, be to keep the current interface, and that's what a number of other specs do as well, as I've seen. For example, the geolocation API has the options after the callback, and WebRTC does the same. There are the links to two specs have the options after the callback.
Yeah, I don't... But the options after the callback is something that's rarely used. At least it's... I mean, geolocation's a pretty old... WebRTC's new. Geolocation's pretty old. And these don't necessarily... That's not the way things are done in something like Node.js. Like, I think there's a lot of source code out there that has the callback as the last... option.
That's the way it is in Ruby. if you specify the callback as a parameter, it's the last option.
Yeah,
it's general practice, and it's always what people expect. It's callback last.
I think the way RTC peer connection stuff, this stuff has not gone through the process as much as any other spec, and I would expect them to change that.
Yeah, it's just I just looked at a couple of other specifications what they are doing, because I mean that's a common problem, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Robin for his kind of preference what to do, and he said, well, he would prefer most to use futures, but I already told him that that's probably not what we are going to do. Then he said the next thing he would suggest is to just use method overloading and ship it, even though that means that we are shipping it, knowing that it's probably a bug in web idle, because currently that wouldn't work. And the last thing he said, otherwise we should just keep what we currently have. Like that hack that Dave proposed to have both optional and then raise an error, that's really too hackish according to him.
Okay. Okay, so the easiest thing or the best thing to do is just to keep what we have?
Or do method overloading.
Method overloading. Knowing that we depend on, well, on a bug in WebIDLE currently, and it's not sure if that's really a bug or if it's intended to be that way.
Mm.
So the thing is, let me
let's
try.
Not do that. I just don't think we should depend on a bug in WebIDLE. I mean, I think what we should be doing is just expressing it in the way that we intend it to be used, and not, you know, in ways that abuse or assume certain things in WebIDL are going to be fixed in a particular way.
Yeah, well, then we have to keep options last.
No, we don't.
Why not?
Maybe I don't understand the problem. Why can't we just detect the incoming data and see what it is, and then the algorithm does the right thing based on that?
That's not the issue, Mona. The issue is that the spec says we cannot declare the last parameter as being non-optional if a parameter that comes prior to it is optional.
Okay, so why can't we put something in the spec saying that this is not, you know, this is a bug in WebIDL, that you can't do this, and that bug is currently being worked on, but you know, we know that you can implement it like this.
That would then be the option of using method overloading. Then you could do that. Otherwise you couldn't. You can't have an optional parameter before a required parameter.
What I'm saying is that the assertion that you can't have an optional parameter before a required parameter is a bug in WebIDL. Right?
No, that's not a bug in WebIDL. The bug in WebIDL is that currently dictionaries and callbacks, you can't distinguish them, and that's why method overloading wouldn't work.
Hold on, in WebIDL you can?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, sorry. So that's the bug. I guess what I'm trying to say is there is a bug in WebIDL that is preventing us from expressing the callback in the correct way. And so rather than change our interface, we should say, hey, there is a bug in WebIDL that prevents this from being used. It is implementable in this way. Please use the mechanism that we show above.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is our WebIDL definition needs to be changed, even if we keep the parameter in the same position.
Okay, to what?
So if we want to have the callback before the options, we need to change the WebIDL to use method overloading. And
so if
there is a bug in WebIDL.
So we could declare every method twice, once
yeah.
with the options, once without the options.
Exactly. and we have to add an issue marker or something that's currently a bug in Web IDL, because it wouldn't be allowed as Web IDL currently stands.
It seems like we're doing a lot of dancing around because of bugs in Web IDL. And we're presenting the information in a way that's harder to understand because of bugs in Web IDL. I'm fine with doing it in the method overloading case if that's what people think is the best thing, but it's really non-optimal because of bugs in Web IDL.
Well, what we certainly can't do is to have an optional parameter before a required parameter, because that clearly, it would work in JavaScript, but for example in C or something else, it wouldn't work. And Web IDL is not just for JavaScript.
Any other comments on desired approach for this?
I think the right way to mark it up is using overloading. That's just the right way to do it, and that way it would work for other languages, and it would work for us, and it would put the parameter in the correct order.
Any other input?
That sounds reasonable to me.
Okay, so the proposal is to express the web IDL for functions with optional parameters using the method overloading web IDL pattern. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what the test harness is going to do once we do that. It probably will blow up some more.
I'd say if we continue to have problems with the test harness, we should just mark it with an issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, the test harness is just a tool. We can write the test also manually there. But in any way, the optional parameters have to be optional.
Okay, so that's resolved. Anything else on the Web IDL?
Maybe just a question to Dave. When do you think that stuff would be ready?
Are you asking when would the JavaScript be ready to do that?
Yeah, just the JavaScript interface.
Well, fixing that will only take like 10 minutes. It's really easy to do. It's fixing the other bugs. Some of them are unfixable. Some of them it's questionable whether or not they should be fixed. So are you asking when would pass that test harness completely?
More or less, yeah.
I don't think it can pass the test harness completely because it won't ever pass that type. At least one of the tests it can't possibly pass, because the type of operator will only ever return object for something implemented in JavaScript.
Okay, yeah, well, that's then something we can't fix, but all the other stuff that we can fix, even if it's ugly, I mean...
We can put some hacks in the file to actually pass the ugly stuff, and it will only pass in certain browsers. We can do that.
I think the thing is more that we have tests. So if, for example, some browser vendor plans to implement that API, that we can test it for conformity. That's the whole exercise we are doing here, I believe.
Right. I mean, for the parts that we care about, we should be able to test for conformance. We really don't care if the constructor of the JSON LD processor is writable or not, or enumerable or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think, and that is something that happens in parallel with us doing the last call. The Web IDL needs to be updated before we put the document into last call. So, Marcus, you're going to have to make sure to do that.
Yeah, I'll do that right after the telecom.
But But the actual web IDL stuff passing, that doesn't have to happen until we go to PR, proposed rec, which happens after last call.
Yeah.
Okay. Next up, issue 223, JSON LD options, base versus base. Excuse me. It doesn't seem like we have, no one's had the time to work on this. The last time we discussed this, we were going to kind of elaborate all of the possibilities, and I just don't think we have had the time to do this. Marcus, I have seen that you've made commits regarding this issue. Do you have any updates?
No, not really. It's just before we allowed relative IRIs as base, and I disallowed that in those comments you're talking about, I think.
Okay.
Because I think that was the consensus, that in either case we don't want to have relative IRIs as base, right?
Yep. Okay, well, are we, the one thing I wanted to make sure is that we're protected against a change in this during last call. So do we do have an issue marker for this?
Yes.
Okay.
We do.
Okay. All right. Good. Then we can skip it. Next topic, issue 229, basically the test suite.
Before we get into that, did we want to cover that corner case?
Yes, we do. Sorry, I totally forgot about that. Trying to find the link. Okay, so
I put a link in IRC.
Okay, what's the topic? Really,
so the topic is, a little while back, Marcus changed the test suite and removed some text from the spec that was put in there based on a resolution we had that said when you compact something, and as the very last step, if you're compacting an array and the array does, and the context is empty, you don't include the @graph keyword in the output. That was what our resolution was, and then there's a proposal to change that so that @graph is always used in compaction output. So effectively, there are two proposals in this link. One that says only include the @graph if a context has been passed, and the other one is to always include @graph.
Or in other words, if you compact, the result will always be an object, or it will sometimes be an array.
It seems
@graph is one of the more difficult things for people to get. And I think there have been a number of suggestions that for the purpose of identifying sort of the default graph, that @graph isn't very useful. So I think that probably trying to avoid it when possible is a reasonable way to go, and why we sort of had that original behavior. I do understand the advantage of always being able to have a predicted form of the result and always having the results come back as an object. But it seems to me that by not specifying a context, the user has in fact determined the form of the data they want, because if you don't have a context, then you would always get an array output.
No, not always.
Well, you would always get whatever you put in. Or if there's one item, you're always going to get an object. If there's more than one, you're always going to get an array.
Yes, right.
There's another question. The question is whether we really allow passing null for the context parameter in the compaction call. Because we use the same thing in flattenant. If we pass null for the context there, then the flattening result will be in expanded form. So the question is whether it wouldn't be simpler to just say you can't pass as null for the context.
I do wonder if people would prefer to just remove things like add value for numbers and strings where they're plain literals, since that would be the effect of passing an empty context.
Wait, so you're saying would people prefer to pass an empty context, empty or null?
There might be a distinction, I don't know.
Is the empty the same as the null context?
I think we have to look at what we're doing with the flattening API to sort of make that decision. If null means don't compact and flatten, will it be confusing if null is the same thing as an empty context in compaction?
Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's going to be confusing to have two things happen based on whether you're passing null or just open, close bracket. I think we should interpret null as open, close bracket.
Yeah, but that would change the output of flatten such that you could not get an expanded form from flatten.
I'm wondering if we should have another option to specify that more explicitly instead of using kind of a trick to do it.
I don't know if it's so much of a trick, but I guess it could be interpreted that way. An empty context means don't replace any terms, but do every other kind of compaction. Whereas null means don't do any compaction.
Yeah, and we could say that in compaction, you obviously want to do compaction, so null is not allowed there for the context parameter.
Yeah, if we threw an error there, it would help with the confusion.
I think there's still going to be confusion around it.
Well, I mean, if you have an empty context, that's really the same as a populated context where no term matches any URI.
Mm-hmm.
So that wouldn't be that confusing in my opinion. But having a null context and nevertheless compact the values but don't do anything else, that's, in my opinion, confusing.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that it's not confusing once it's explained to you, but I think it's a fairly nuanced point, and unless the documentation is very clear about this, it's going to be confusing. And by documentation, I don't mean the spec. I mean the documentation that developers end up using in their language library that they're using to process JSON-LD.
Yeah, so wouldn't it be simpler to remove that variancy?
Well, if we do that, then we're back in the problem that Dave Longley just outlined, right?
No. The problem is there if we don't, if we allow null for compaction and flattening.
Yeah, that's not what I mean. The point I'm trying to make is that we're saying that you can have a null context and a empty context. And you can pass both the null context and the empty context to flatten, but you can't pass the null context to compact, right?
Yeah, the null context in flattening would mean no context,
right,
which is different than an empty context.
It's just that it's that variation, those options that I think are going to be confusing to developers. But I can live with it. I mean, I
don't know that for flatten it's that confusing. I mean, yeah, I could see people wanting to use flatten and get expanded form out. And the way you, that makes sense, you'd pass null for the contacts.
Or you'd set up expand flag. Although then again, I don't know what you'd pass for the contacts. I guess
right.
That's fine.
And
okay.
I think the simplest way forward is just you can pass null, or you can pass null for flatten to get expanded form out. But if you pass null in the compaction API, it's an error.
Okay. Any other thoughts on this?
Well, we still haven't resolved the original question.
Result of compaction is an array.
Yeah,
something
I was going to mention is that already in compacted form, unless you specify by option, the general practice is if there's only one thing, you're going to get an object. If there's more than one thing, you're going to get an array. And we don't expect compaction to produce regular form. That's the purpose of expansion. So I don't see the need for us to produce a regular form as output that always has @graph, especially considering that @graph has some negative connotations, but also I could see how somebody would want to be able to pass in an array and get an array back out, even if they're just using an empty context to compact values.
I didn't follow.
I could see, I think it's already probably a corner case that people are going to use empty contexts. But if somebody is going to be using an empty context and they start out with an array, I would expect that they would just want to get an array back from compaction. They don't want to get something, an object back that has @graph that then has the array that they want to work with inside of it. So then you just have to strip out the @graph and it's kind of annoying.
Mm-hmm.
That, at least that's just my read on it.
Well, either way, you end up having to do the test to see if the thing is an object or an array. You either do the test at the top level, or you get an object back and then test to see if it's got graph or not. Right?
Well, it depends. If you set the compact arrays to false, you don't ever have to do that check.
Wait, is that true?
Well, if you don't, if there is no context, otherwise it would be in @graph, even if you set.
Yeah, we're talking about just for the empty context case. If in this corner case where somebody wants to use an empty context, that's the only place where this really applies.
Mm-hmm.
So we could talk about.
Yeah, but I mean, typically, as far as I know, JSON developers usually want to have an object at the top level and not an array. I know that @graph is not the simplest feature we have, or the default graph, but at least it's consistent and you always get back an object. And if it's more than one object, you have the @graph, and that's all you need to check, regardless of what kind of context you pass.
Yeah, I mean, when I first looked at this issue, I thought that that's what we wanted to do. Even though @graph is kind of annoying, that at least getting back an object, you're always getting back an object, would be simpler for web developers. Because you always have to do the test. You always have to check to see if the thing has @graph or if it's just a top-level object.
Yeah.
The other approach is, you know, you test to see if the thing you got back is an array or an object. I personally like proposal one, which is we always wrap the thing in graph if the thing is an array.
Yeah, me too. It's my preference as well.
I don't feel all that strongly about it. I don't mind simplifying the code, obviously. It would be easier to do that.
Okay.
I also think it's enough of a corner case that it probably doesn't matter that much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Greg, what do you think? I know you have felt the kind of the opposite.
Well, I don't feel strongly about it. I'll go with the consensus view.
Okay.
Yeah, my only concern with it would be if it ends up being less of a corner case where, I don't know, people end up compacting a lot with an empty context just to simplify things, and they always have to deal with that graph being there. I can see someone complaining about it, but I don't know that.
Well, I mean, it's simple enough to alias that graph to data or something.
Right.
What if they don't pass an empty context? I mean, they're passing in an empty context, which means that it's just gonna everything's gonna be expanded, right?
No. If you pass in an empty context, all the values are compacted. It just doesn't use any terms.
No, I see. Okay. Here's a proposal. Okay. All right. That was. Let's see. Oh, then the last. Anything else on this issue before we move on?
Could we maybe have a resolution for making context not nullable in compact?
Sure. When a context is passed into the compact function call, it must not be the null value. If a null value is detected, an error must be thrown. Is that what we wanted?
Yeah.
Right, that's resolved. Okay, anything else before we move on? All right, next up is the test suite. Greg has done quite a bit of work on this already. Thank you so much for that, Greg. Would you mind giving us a quick rundown?
Yeah, so the first thing I did was I made changes to the test suite to allow it to be treated as a normal sort of RDF style suite, and as a result be able to report, to generate an URL report, which is right here. Of course, this doesn't actually include any test results, but it does show basically processing all of the manifests as RDF, turning them back into JSON-LD, using that to generate turtle, as well as the HTML, HTML plus RDFA output. Marcus suggested a couple of other changes, which I think we can do. This whole thing is driven by a query that is used to query the manifest, and the manifest is such that we can use the default query for doing that, as well as a HAML template, sort of HAML plus Markdown, which is then used to generate the output, and it it iterates over the JSON LD representation of this to do this. So Marcus asked that we include some information such as test number, I think, and the descriptions, which is easy enough to do. What it does not do and is more difficult because we're using generic software for doing the URL reporting, so it knows about test inputs and outputs. It doesn't know about contexts, for instance. So when I'm showing the test definitions, I will show the input and output files, but I don't show, say, the contexts or other types of documents that may accompany it. And I'm not exactly sure how to do that and keep the software generic. But we could always fork it and do a JSON-LD specific version of this. And then secondly, I did a simple jQuery and mustache plugin to list the test manifests within the test suite file here. And that uses a single script element of type application / LD plus JSON with a reference to the driving manifest that it then loads and uses that to load each of the individual manifests, which it prints out here by iterating through that and all of the sequence elements. I did need to make a couple of changes, which I think Dave Lane caught, and I think it broke his testing infrastructure. I am sorry about that. There are some cases you'll note, if we get down to the JSON, to the RDF tests, I think we include, in addition to the test input and output, we include purpose, because those test manifests included a purpose section, which the others do not. So higher up, we don't have that, so it's basically just name, input, and output. Obviously, these things could also be formatted better, but that's really not my strong point. But at this point, I think we can improve the output through a combination of CSS and then just adding stuff to the manifest themselves. This should also have a reference to the test result, of course. And then we also need to be sure that we describe everything that a developer would need to be able to run the test. Turtle does that using a wiki entry. And in particular, they'll define various different types for both syntax tests and evaluation tests, positive and negative, and what it means to run those types of things. I don't believe we have any syntax tests. It might be useful to do that. I think the purpose of a syntax test is just to make sure that a processor will take sort of corner case formats without actually doing anything with them. And then the evaluation test would actually do that. A negative evaluation test parses and runs it and then expects an exception to be generated as a result of running it. So that would be appropriate for some of the types of tests that we want to do. Our own tests are set up with more of a hodgepodge of classes. I think we have two or three classes per test. It's not clear that is any better than sort of the single type that Turtle uses. On the other hand, Turtle sort of requires that the test harness sort of have built-in knowledge about how to deal with those specific types. So, whereas ours is perhaps a little bit more composed of saying this is an expansion test, and I think we have some error cases where there's another type that's added to it that would affect the way that you run it.
So do you think that, I mean, we do need to tell people how to run the test suite and how to get it and all that kind of stuff. But do you think that we have most of the stuff in place to ask people to kind of run this test suite against their implementations?
Well, in order to get reports, and of course we did this earlier with Turtle, and we will have to ask people to redo it, because the question of where the tests are, what the default base is, and I think that we do where we expect the default base, that is a property of the manifest. What that default base is probably should be consistent with where it we expect it to live in the long term in W3C space. I think there were some other changes that Sandro suggested with regards to adding resolutions for the tests being approved, and that would imply having a different status of the tests, which would allow you to only test approved tests. I think there's an additional step for optional tests, which could then affect the URL reports that would be used for conformance reporting. So in particular, the test location, so the location of the URIs is then used to convert. So I had to add URIs to every test definition in the form of a hash URI, so that there is a well-known endpoint against which someone can assert whether they pass or fail it. But that is part of the full URI based upon the manifest location, which also would be affected by where the sort of the canonical location of the test manifest is. And I don't know that we have enough information documented in the sort of the test suite index file on how to run the tests. So I think that requires a little bit of review.
So just a couple of quick questions. None of the files resolve right now, and I guess that's because we still need to figure out which file we're actually going to load.
None of which files resolve?
The ones on the JSON-LD test suite. So if you click on expand 5 in JSON-LD, one of the tests, it doesn't show the contents.
Oh, I think, yeah, what happens to me is, sorry, hold on, let me pull that back up again. It downloads. I think that's the browser behavior.
I'm get a 404 not found.
There is a subdirectory missing.
That
switch / tests / expand or compact or whatever.
Yes, right. Okay. That's easy enough fix.
Sure.
But that is the effect, by the way, when I do this. So if you... Actually, I don't think I could put the link in the reports, because ideally the example would link, but you can't put a link in the example text. Certainly, if someone wants to look at this output template and improve the way we do that, that would be great too. But in terms of what the browser behavior is, I don't know if there's a way to override that in the anchor link.
You mean the download?
Yeah, because it doesn't show. When I run it,
it
doesn't show it.
It's doing it because of the MIME type that's
right
associated with it. So we could add an htaccess file and say that these should be served as JSON documents, and we might use the link header trick just so that people in the browser can click on it and see it instead of it being downloaded to their machine.
Yeah. Alternatively, you know, we could do some AJAX stuff and just show it in a pop-up.
Yep, that's true. That might be good too. I mean, the whole site needs to be kind of moved over. Ideally, we'd redo the site in Bootstrap and get some of that stuff in there. But again, time is not...
Well, the good news is that this is not on a critical path, right? What's on a critical path is getting the information in there, not having it be pretty. So we can make it pretty when we have more time for that.
Okay, anything else on the test suite?
I was just going to put in, I put in RC a minor nitpick that we, I think we should use the add type at vocab feature to mark the tests up. Just for, you know, okay.
We could possibly use that vocab, but most of the properties come from a variety of different, there's the MF, the, you know, testing infrastructure. There's something that we use as JLD right now. So we've defined terms for all of these.
Right. I'm talking about using at type at vocab to sort of turn them into little enumerative types. Like JLD colon positive evaluation test could just be positive evaluation test by using the at vocab.
Oh, for the classes. Yeah, yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do we do with error tests and tests of the API flags? Do we want to add some tests for that as well, or do we create variations of the existing tests? Or
I think we certainly need a way to, when we need a generic way of saying that when something's run, expect an error, we may want to be able to say more about the detail of that error, and I think I saw in those cases the result was a string rather than a an IRI, which is a little odd because now the range of that particular property varies. We may want to use a different property to indicate some more detail we expect in the error. Having a generic way of identifying that this is a error sort of an evaluation, a negative evaluation test, and I would propose that we sort of move over to the type of nomenclature used in the turtle tests for that. Although doesn't need to be off of that same namespace, but that would provide some consistency for the way that people run RDF tests in terms of invoking the doing the evaluation with different options, then either define a property which serializes the options that should be provided, or a property for each option that should be added to the API call. But we do need to separate from sort of the normal evaluation algorithm invocation from the web idle part, and we might need separate tests for the web idle interfaces as opposed to the sort of the algorithmic cases. And I think the evaluation tests would be tests of the algorithms in accordance with the way it is with Turtle and other RDF processors.
Yep. I don't know if there's an example of testing an API like this. Let me put it another way. I think that the way that most APIs like this are tested are in browser. Right? You give an endpoint to the JavaScript file, and then there's a test suite that you click run on, and it'll run the test suite against using that JavaScript file as the kind of input. And then it'll dump out the results. So what I'm saying is that a lot of those types of tests are done outside of a test suite like the one we have. The one we have is meant mostly for like command line based processors, not necessarily API processors. And it's easier to write API based processor tests in something that's in browser.
Well, if you're testing some JavaScript
right, exactly.
implementation.
Right, exactly. So that's the problem here, is that the other alternative is, okay, now we need an endpoint, and we need to be able to invoke the API over that RESTful, you know, interface. I mean, this is kind of what we have in the RDFA, case. But putting that type of test suite together is a fairly painful process.
I expect we'll see a number of implementations that don't implement the API. I'm really not particularly interested in implementing, being rigidly implementing the API myself. And so reporting conformance against it isn't something that's, I think, of value to the Ruby community.
Right. Yeah. Or on our side, as far as the full API, we're only implementing a very small portion of it. So at this point, just enough to make us where we can get our work done. I mean, we don't need all of it for internal application use.
You mean that you're just implementing expand and compact and flatten, or you just some sense of expand, compact, and flatten?
We're implementing all of expand, and we've implemented all of expand. We will be working on compact, but we're really just using expand so we can do some serialization. What happens on our client side is it all gets turned into a RDF triples anyway, into a JSON triple store. So
okay.
We really don't care about a lot of the more of the JSON LD type stuff. We're using it as a serialization, an easy serialization format.
Okay. All right. Well, we are 11 minutes over. We should probably end the call. Marcus, just to make sure, you're going to go in and update the last call specs.
Yeah.
And then ping me so that I can sync them to W3C.
Yeah.
I am sending out 3 emails to WebRec, the chairs, all the chairs of W3C, and forget the third one. I have it open.
Sandra. Tom Ressler.
Well, no, I'm sending it to WebRec, and Sandra and Yvonne.
And Bob Rules.
Pub Rules, yeah, WebRec. Yes, thank you. Well, no, that was the first one.
Dave and Hoos, I presume you're CCing on all this stuff?
Yeah, so I'm sending it to WebRec, and then Marcus Sandro, David Wood, Hoos, and Yvonne. So that's to let them know.
Was there a Thomas or something in there you needed to send it to?
Thank you, yes. Tom Rosler. So I'm sending something to Tom Rosler, Yvonne, and Sandro, just so he knows that it's coming down the pipe. Okay, and then the chairs. So 3 emails from me. Okay, and I don't think that we need to do anything else. So the only thing that we need to do is just go to the RDF working group tomorrow and tell them all the docs are ready for publication on Thursday, and then see if they plus one the publication. All right. Anything else that people can think of that we need to do?
Well, I just, with regards to some of my suggestions on Test Suite, sort of settling on the positive-negative syntax evaluation test types rather than sort of 2 or 3 types for each test. Is that something that I should do? People want to discuss that offline some more, or what?
Would that make it so that...
Sorry, I didn't really understand what you're proposing. Or...
So Turtle, the type of each test is one of 4 different types. It's a Turtle positive syntax test, negative syntax test, positive evaluation test, or negative evaluation test. Now, we have other types in there that describe them as being expansion tests, compaction tests, flattening tests, etc. I'm wondering, do we want to try to consolidate so that each test has a single type, and then we describe the semantics of that type and use a standardized form for it in our test suite, or are we happy with the way it is right now? The one thing I heard Dave suggest is that we, rather than using queries for the types, we define. I think you suggested we use @vocab and use simple terms.
Right. I do think we should do that. Is this suggestion mainly that we move the expansion test type out of the type property and put it in another property?
Or no, I would say that the type property should define that it is a, for instance, it might be a positive expansion evaluation test or a positive compaction.
IRC. That's what you mean, right?
That would be so. That would be another way to do it. Is that you give it two types, and then that's closer to what we have right now. Would be a positive evaluation. That is okay. That's what I did. Yeah, that's what I did. Is a yeah. So
and
this.
What
I mean,
would
that,
you change
this,
it to?
It could be a single type, say positive compaction evaluation test.
Oh, okay.
That would be.
I prefer to keep it in two. I prefer two different things, not one.
All right. So that the so what one thing I will do is change it to be terms, and I'll define a vocab. The JLD is basically the vocab.
That'd be great.
Well, instead of, you could do that, or instead of doing that, just define each term using at type at vocab.
Yeah.
Unless we really want to set the vocab, I don't know.
Yeah, you just have
well,
to...
Well, we do need to find these types. We do need to define the types. Right now, this we use a vocabulary that isn't actually, doesn't resolve.
Actually,
no
I think if you
it.
Did add vocab, I don't... Oh, you're doing it in app type, so it would work. Okay.
Yeah. We don't actually have this vocabulary is not actually defined any place. So we do need to define the term certainly within the test suite file, and probably doing it as RDFA makes some sense. But since we're, I don't know if we want to also create a JSON LD definition of the vocabulary terms, if that's important or not.
Eh. So I think
I thought we already had a little context in there that defined them.
We do, yeah.
Okay.
But the vocabulary itself doesn't resolve. It's not. We're sort of not eating our own dog food in that regards because we're using a URI, which is not also a URL.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of things that we need to discuss with the test suite. Just I mean they're kind of minor details, but I don't think that we could go through all of them, you know, now, especially since we're 17 minutes over. So I think we might want to open up a couple of bugs on the test suite in the issue tracker, things that we think should be there. And then maybe the next call that we have will go through those issues and try and make some decisions on the test suite, what we really want to see on the test suite. That make that seem like a good thing to do?
Works for me.
All right. All right. So we're 17 minutes past. Anything else before we go? All right. Thanks for the great call. We'll see the Greg and Marcus. We'll see you on the RDF working group call tomorrow. For everyone else, have a great week, and we'll see everyone next Tuesday.
Great. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.